Okay, folks.
Welcome back to Youth and reminder again, your case is due for class on Wednesdays before 10:30. So we will be talking about the case in class. You don't have to wait till 10:29 to send it, so we get done tomorrow, today, whenever. Just remember the stuff there, right? Lo and behold, right? So wasn't trying to be clever, maybe I was, but this way to when you do send it, a couple of things, because it's a group project and one of you might be sending it, make sure you blank carbon copy or CC or just make it regular CC or everybody else in your group. That way when it's graded and I return it to you, I can return it to all of you at the same time, so you're not passing it around. And I prefer it to be a PDF file, not a Word file, not an Excel file, a PDF file. It's easier for me to put my comments on the PDF file. Same thing with Excel sheet, you can convert the PDF format to PDF. Okay. Any questions about the logistics of the case? Now, I've had quite a few questions about the case itself, and I've been very evasive when I've been asking these questions. Not sorry. It's still low. Working. It might not be loud enough. The reason I've been evasive actually is not because I cannot give you an answer, but because there's some part of the case that I've deliberately left the assumptions pink. Partly because in the real world, you wouldn't be given those assumptions to estimate them anyway. And that's something that we have to deal with. The other is, I want to see whether the assumptions you make are reasonable. Not all assumptions are reasonable, so in a sense, but the assumptions are reasonable, whether the rest of your analysis is consistent with whatever assumptions you make. So no questions of case, right? So today I'm going to continue our discussion in lesson analysis. You remember I started this process of looking at an iron ore project. We finished it in the DC park, we sliced it, we diced it, we accepted it. But the way we looked at it, we looked at it from the perspective of the entire business. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Professor, so sorry for interrupting. Your mic is not working again. We can't hear you clearly.
And let me try it again. Now is it working?
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Hopefully it'll stay working. So we talked about the Disney theme park. We looked at it from the perspective of the entire company. And this is how it plays out, right? When we looked at earnings and cash flows, we looked at earnings and cash flows before debt payments. When we looked at what the cost of the project, when we looked at the cost of overall capital, everything was done through the perspective of the entire company. So today's session, I want to start by looking at this iron ore project, but putting an equity perspective. What does that mean? I want you to think like equity investors. I want you to be absolutely selfish. You don't care about the rest of the world. It's all about you. What do you get as earnings? What do you get as cash flows? What do you demand as a return? And towards the last few minutes of the last session, we talked about how this plays out. First, I now have to explicitly factor in debt payments, right? Because if I'm going to look at cash flows equity, I can't just wave my hands and there's debt. I have to figure out how much interest payment, how much principal payment, because those are going to be cash outflows to me. And when I look at my discount rate, because it's all about equity, I'm focused on cost of equity. And the discount rate I'm going to use for this project is a dollar cost of equity for iron ore projects. Why? Because I'm doing my cash flows in US dollars. It's an equity cash flow. And why iron ore? Because it's an iron ore market. So let's look at what the numbers look like if you do an equity analysis. And I want you to contrast this with what we did with the Disney theme park. I start with revenues, so that's always the case. Whether you're doing cash flows of the firm or cash flows equity, that's not going to change. I subtract my operating expenses here. There's both fixed and variable costs. And I'm doing everything in nominal terms because I want nominal dollars. Later we'll say, what if I want to do everything in real terms? But basically I come up with operating income. And when we did the Disney theme park, we acted like we paid tax on the operating income. Here, I'm not going to do that. Why? Because as an equity investor, I get to subtract out interest expenses. So the reason I had to do the breakdown of how much of the expense each year was interest is the interest is tax deductible. when you subtract interest income, interest expense from that operating income, you come up with taxable income. I pay taxes, I come up with net income. The minute you say the words net income, you're talking about an equity income. That's why we have to be careful about the way we define earnings. If you're looking at pre-interest income, you can talk about after-tax operating income. Here it's net income. Now, I'm going to do what I did with the Disney theme park and start with an accounting measure of return. But this time, the return I'm going to compute is a return to equity investors. So my earnings are net income. And when I look at how much I've invested in the project, remember, all I care about is my portion of the investment. Let me explain. This iron ore mine is going to cost $1.25 billion. But half a billion of that is going to come from debt. So I've got to come up with only 750 million. So what I'm tracking here is the book value of equity each year rather than the book value of overall capital. So with each item, my perspective is different because I'm focused just on the equity part. So I've got net income, I've got book value of equity. If I divide the net income by the book value of equity, I come up with a return in equity. Return in equity measures return to equity investors. Net income goes in the numerator, book value of equity goes in the denominator. And the average ROE for this project is 31.36%. What do I compare it to? I compare it to my cost of equity in dollar terms, 11.13%. And this project looks like a good project on an accounting return basis. Take a look at how those returns mount up over time. I mean, this happened with the Disney theme park as well, but it wasn't as pronounced a change. You know why the return equity is changing so much more in this project? What is different about this project relative to the Disney theme park that's causing the return equity to climb so quickly as you go through time? Go ahead, somebody. Go ahead.
Yeah, but you have the capital expenditure at the very beginning, but it's very big, and then the depreciation starts mounting.
And it's a finite life project, right? At the end of the period, what happens, the project is done. I salvage it. There's no continuing value. I'm behaving very differently because it's a finite life project. So my invested capital drops off. Any time you have a finite life project, your returns are going to mount over time. And if I look at the average return equity, 31%, well above my cost of equity. Let me pause there and let me make sure people are clear and comfortable with the net income book equity. Yes. How did I get, the interest rate was given, right? I broke it down. Remember last class, we broke down the total payment. It was a term loan. If, in fact, on this page, if it had been a balloon payment loan rather than a term loan, what would this table look like? You know what a balloon payment loan is? I borrow 500 million. I pay only interest for the next 10 years. And at the end of the 10th year, I pay off the principal. It's a much easier computation then, right? Because the interest is going to be constant over time because I borrowed 500 million. The end of the 10th year, I now have to pay off the 500 million. With a term loan, it's a little trickier because the total payment stays the same, 61.8 million, but the proportions change every year because early on is more interest and later on, it's mostly principal. Any other questions on? Somebody on Zoom had a question? So now let's talk about computing this return equity across companies. Remember we did that tangent with return on capital. We looked at how will this play out in a company. I'm just going to take a brief tangent again. Can we do this at the company level? Absolutely. I can take the net income of a company and divide by book value of equity. And some people divide by starting book value of equity, some divide by average. Some I really don't care. It doesn't make a big deal. So pick one, just stay consistent. This shouldn't be something you spend an hour debating. It's really not worth the difference. I'll tell you why I use beginning of the year numbers. If you think about what we're assuming when we do our analysis, we operate in a time that's very weird, right? Everything happens in the last day of each year. If that's the assumption you're making about your earnings and cash flows, that everything happens at a point in time at the end of each year, then it's consistent to actually use beginning of the year numbers. You know when you should be using average numbers? Is some people have this fixation, what's called a mid-year convention, where instead of looking at the end of each year, they act like the cash flows happen in the middle of each year. One of the biggest wastes of time, if you ask me, in capital budgeting, but somehow they think this makes for more precision. If you're in the middle of the year person, that's how you think things happen, then the return on equity and return on capital should probably also be computed using an average number, just to be consistent the way you think about the world. So now let's, you know, if I compute this for Disney, I take the net income divided by book value of equity, I come up with the return on equity of 14.62%. What am I going to do with it? I'm going to compare to the cost of equity for Disney as a company. And as with return on capital, what am I seeing? I'm seeing that Disney is earning well above its cost of equity. I'll tell you when you're going to find this equity approach particularly useful. It shouldn't be on any of your projects because none of you are doing financial service companies. But if you're working with financial service companies, don't even try to compute return on invested capital. It'll drive you crazy. That's a one area where you're going to see return on equity kind of dominate because it's very difficult to define what the book value of invested capital is for a JP Morgan or an Allstate or a Goldman Sachs. So we've got an accounting measure of return for this project. It looks like a good project. Let's go from earnings to cash flows. The adjustments are exactly the same. Add back depreciation, subtract change in working capital. But there's one other adjustment that you see here that you did not see when I did the Disney theme park. So I'm adding depreciation, just like I did the Disney theme park. Subtract CapEx. The only difference here is there's CapEx only up front. And there's no maintenance CapEx. Why? Because the project ends after the finite period. Change in working capital. But now I have to bring in debt payments. Why? Because as an equity investor, when I have to repay debt, that's cash leaving the company. And in this case, that table that we constructed comes in useful because I can figure out how much is principal repaid. I subtract it out. And at the end of the 10th year, I shut the project down. I get back my salvage value. And I'm assuming the salvage value is equal to book value. I know I'm giving away something that might be helpful in the case, but I'm going to give it away anyway. You know why the most convenient assumption to make about salvage value is to set it equal to book value? If your salvage value, let's say you assume a salvage value different from your book value. There's one more thing you got to clean up for, right? Let's say I'd assume the salvage value is zero, that nobody would pay me for this mine at the end of 10 years, because who wants a hole in the ground and all the environmental disasters that come with it? If I did that, what's the cleaning up I need to do? What happens when you sell something for either above book value or below book value? There's a tax effect that has to play in. When you sell things for book value, the nice thing is there's no tax effect. It's not a big deal, but you have to bring in capital gains taxes. So to me, the most convenient assumption, since it doesn't make a big deal in most projects, is to set book value equal to salvage value and kind of move on. And if you look at the salvage value, basically here, in addition to getting my salvage value of the mine, the physical assets back, I also salvage my working capital. What does that mean? Well, when I shut the business down, I don't throw the inventory out on the street and tell people who owe me money, they don't have to pay me. I collect my receivables, I sell at cost. I'm not even assuming any major profits, but essentially the working capital being salvaged is I'm basically getting back my inventory and receivables when the project ends. So I've got my cash flows to equity. Now that I have my cash flows to equity, I can discount them back at the cost of equity. So if you get a chance, take the Disney theme park and the iron ore project, put them next to each other and look at the differences that play out when you go with an equity approach. You discount cash flow at equity at the cost of equity, the net present value you get for the project is $304 million. In this case, I get confirmation of what I found with my accounting return. This is a good project. It adds $304 million to my value, the company's equity. So the same properties apply. NPVs are still additive. And usually you get pretty similar results using both approaches. So if you ask me which one is better, if you do it right, you should get roughly the same answer. But which one do you think is more work? I mean, think lazy. If they give you the same answer, you want to take the least path of least resistance, right? When I did my cash flow of the firm, there was debt in the project, but I completely ignored it, right? At least in the cash flows where I showed it almost entirely in my discount rate. Here, I have to work through the effects into my cash flows. Interest payments and principal payments have to be explicitly played out on this project to come up with cash flows to equity. Cash flows to equity is always a path of more resistance. So you're saying, why would I ever do it? If you have a hugely levered project, like you do in leverage transaction, you know why you might want to consider cash flow to equity? Because it'll put up red flags when you're getting into danger. Because if your cash flow to equity are big negative numbers, it tells you that you're going to have a cash burn on this project. And that's something at least you should know. And if you're a company that's cash crunch, that might potentially tilt you away from the project. Whereas when you do cash flow to the firm, it's a pre-debt cash flow. You're completely oblivious to the fact that this project looks good pre-debt, but at least it might still end up with the same NPV, but you got to live through those early years of negative cash flows. Any questions on cash flow to equity, cost of equity, NPV? Yes.
Two questions. I know in the last class we looked at using sensitivity analysis.
Yeah.
What do you think about using a margin of safety instead of a sensitivity analysis?
It's the same thing, right? A margin of safety is after you've computed the NPV or the IRR. So let's say you come up with the IRR, right? You know, in the standard analysis, we said the IRR is greater than the discount rate. You take the project. All a margin of safety says, an IRR has to be at least 3% higher than my discount rate. A margin of safety is not a risk adjustment process. It's a post-analysis bringing in of some kind of buffer into your decision process. So a margin of safety can never replace a traditional analysis. It's a post-analysis add-on that allows you to build in some buffer. Now, if I wanted to do IRR, I'm going to do my NPV profile, because as I said, I don't trust that one number that comes from an IRR. And it's useful to know how much my NPV will change as my discount rate changes. And guess what? I have such a huge buffer for safety here that getting the discount rate wrong is not my worry here, because I'm talking about an IRR that in this case is almost 30%. It's like 28-something%. This is a project that looks good both on an NPV basis and IRR basis. And basically from that perspective, the project passes muster on every single dimension. Now I'm going to ask a what if question. Remember the Disney project? I did everything in dollars and then I said, what if I'd done everything in reais? And with this fairly torturous process, we concluded that it wouldn't have made a difference if I was consistent about doing both my cash flows and my discount rate in reais. In this case, I've done my analysis in nominal dollars. The inflation rate was a US dollar inflation rate. I could have asked you what would be different about doing everything in Canadian dollars, but you can see the differences between the dollar, US and Canadian dollar are so small. But I want to ask a different question. What if I'd done everything in real terms? You think, what does that even mean? If you go back and review the assumptions I made about this particular case, I assumed that the iron ore price would actually be constant in real terms. When you looked at the projections, the numbers didn't look constant because I was bringing in inflation every year. I actually had to work to come up with those prices because those prices are nominal prices. But I could have done everything in real terms, right? Left the price as at a, whatever, the $100 per ton, done the cash flows without inflation affect either my revenues or my expenses. I'd have come up with real earnings and real cash flows. But if my, and those cash flows have been higher or lower than the cash flows I got with nominal numbers. If I take inflation out, they're going to be lower, right? Because I'm taking inflation out. You're saying that's going to hurt me on the NPV basis? Not really. And here's why. Remember that 11.13% cost of capital I used? That was a US dollar cost of capital. I'm sorry, cost of equity. If I wanted to do a real cost of equity, what would I need to do? I need to take inflation out of the 11.13%. My discount rate would drop by roughly, in fact, exactly the same amount as my cash flows would be affected. Try it out if you want. Do everything in real terms. Use a real cost of equity. And the NPV you get would still be about $304 million. It's actually, to me, it's very comforting that changing currencies doesn't matter, going from nominal to real doesn't matter, because it effectively means you make your choice and just stay consistent. What will get you into trouble if you go back and forth between nominal and real, between dollars and pesos or dollars and reais, because that's when you mix and match. At the risk of stating the obvious, when you take a commodity project, the biggest factor that's going to drive what happens to the actual numbers in this project is what happens to commodity prices over time. Think about an oil company that took a project in 2019, looking at the same project in March of 2020, saying, what changed? The oil price dropped by almost 50%. Project that looked good in November of 2019 would have looked terrible in 2020. And today it's going to look great because oil prices are back up to $100 a barrel. So one of the what ifs I asked was, what will happen to the net present value of this iron ore project if the iron ore price changed? In my base case, I used $100, but if I'd used 90 or 80, you can very quickly see NPV start to drop off. It's stating the obvious, but if my price drops by 10% for iron ore, this project goes from being a good project to a bad project. That's going to be true for any commodity company. Will I be affected by exchange rates? Yes. If the Canadian dollar becomes stronger relative to the US dollar, my net present values become lower. You know why? Because my costs are all in Canadian dollars. My revenues are in US dollars. If the Canadian dollar gets weaker, the NPV is going to be higher. So again, at the risk of stating the obvious, if exchange rates change on this project, the NPV will change. The effect is not as catastrophic. It takes a big change in exchange rates here, and it's unlikely that you'll see that much of a change in the Canadian dollar. It'll be very different while doing this in reais or pesos, where big changes are more common. You see where the difference between what I'm doing in the Disney theme park and here. Disney theme park, I was more worried about my micro assumptions. Did I get my theme park numbers right? Are my costs in Brazil going to be different? Here, what I'm worried about are macro things, right? Things I don't control. But there is an advantage with macro variables that you don't have with micro variables. With macro variables, you have products out there, options, futures you can use to hedge these risks, right? There are futures in iron ore. There are futures on exchange rates, on currencies. So one of the questions that I want to ask you is about hedging in general. One of the reasons I want to pose this question is there are a lot of hedging products now that did not exist 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 60 years ago. You can go out and hedge most macroeconomic risks. But the question I'm going to push you on, should you be hedging? So I'm going to break down the macro risks here. And you tell me whether you as, you know, in this case, Vale, should be going out and hedging these risks. First, iron ore prices clearly matter. Should I, as an iron ore producing company, be hedging against movements in iron ore prices? It's actually a big question for commodity companies, right? Should oil companies be hedging against oil prices moving? What do you think?
Long oil.
Right. So I agree with you, but try to, because I'll give you the investment banking pitch they would hear is, if you hedge against commodity prices, your earnings will be more stable. And that's absolutely true, right? So that seems like a good thing. We're told that stable earnings are better than unstable earnings, but I think you're absolutely right. And tell me as an investor why it's going to piss you off if an oil company you've invested in went out and hedged against oil prices 2 years ago. Because when you hedge, what price do you get on oil? usually get a futures price. And in normal times, you know, the futures price always is the spot price adjusted for the cost of storage and interest rates. It's a very simple, so it's not an expected price of oil. It's actually today's price of oil adjusted for this difference. So if oil price are $40 and you go in and lock in that price in futures markets, what are you doing? You're building in the expectation, or actually the guarantee, that you can sell your oil at $40, which is fine, right? If oil stays at 40, or, and you're going to be happy if it drops to 20. But if oil prices go to 100, what are you expecting as an investor in the company? You're expecting to make money. And then I tell you, you know what, guys? We're making the same amount of money we made in 2020. Barrick, which is a gold mining company, about 10 years ago, decided to hedge against gold prices. And gold prices soared after they hedged. The top management team almost entirely lost their jobs as a consequence. So if you're a company whose core existence is built around a commodity, going out and hedging against that commodity price moving could be potentially disastrous, with a couple of exceptions. If you're a shale oil company with a lot of debt, you might want to hedge at least some of your production. Tell me what's different about ExxonMobil. I said, don't hedge. It's not your job. Let your investors take care of that risk, flows through. But what might be different about a company with a lot of, an oil company with a lot of leverage? Why might hedging still benefit you, at least on a portion of the risk? What are you trying to protect against? It's not variability in earnings, right? That every oil company faces. But if oil prices change enough, you could go bankrupt. Remember, the essence of running a commodity company is you got to live through the cycle, right? To live through the cycle, you got to be able to survive through the cycle. So if I were making a prediction, I would expect more levered oil companies to use hedging, not against all production, but against a portion of the prices, saying if that happens, we're in trouble. So we're going to hedge against. So rather than hedge all risk, you might say, if oil prices drop below $50 a barrel, which is our break-even point, we want to be protected. So we're going to go out and buy protection, futures with options. So with commodity prices, it's very iffy whether you should be hedging. The case of Vale in 2013, I'd have been inclined to say, just leave it. No, you're not levered enough for this to be an issue. And if I'm buying shares in your company, I'm buying it because I want to make a play on iron ore prices. What about exchange rates? You know, exchange rates are the most hedged macroeconomic risk in the world. So when companies take projects in other countries, they go out and try really hard. Do you think that's a good idea? And what would the answer depend on? Do you remember when we talked about Disney and adjusting the cost of capital for the Brazil theme park? The question we asked was, should we be increasing the discount rate because there's exchange rate risk? And there we concluded that we shouldn't, not because Disney is not affected by the risk, but because investors in Disney were global investors who could take care of the risk on their own, almost effortlessly, right? If you're a global investor, it's not like you have to buy futures and options. Just in the process of creating your portfolio, the risk disappears. Now, if every company in your portfolio goes out and hedges risk and pays for it, you're paying for something you don't need. So I would go look at the top shareholders in Vale. And if they're global investors, my answer is, it'll make you feel more comfortable as managers. It always makes managers feel more comfortable when they hedge risk. But it's not helping your shareholders, because your typical shareholders can take over. And that's why I asked the last question. If that mine were in Brazil, the risk might be much bigger. And if it makes you really uncomfortable and you can hedge at low cost, then I'll say, go out and do it. But if it's going to cost you a lot, then maybe you need to pick up the phone and call your lead investors and say, hey, what do you think about exchange rate risk? It amazes me that companies don't have a conversation going with their top shareholders as to what they think about things like exchange rate risk. So I'm going to show you a picture that it looks like a complicated picture that I look at anytime I get asked this question, should we be hedging against this risk? So let's start at the top. What's the cost of hedging the risks? If the cost is close to zero, You know what I'm going to say? Go out and hedge the risks. It'll make you feel more comfortable. It costs you close to nothing. If that's what you need to do, go out and do it. But if there's a cost to hedging risk, the question I'm going to ask is, what is your benefit? Show me what you get from hedging the risk. It could be that you get tax benefits. There are some cases where smoothing out earnings for a project will lead you to pay less in taxes. Maybe that's the reason. It could be that you survive the next downturn. So if you have a lot of leverage, that might be the benefit. It could even be a lower discount rate if you're hedging away a major macroeconomic risk. So if there's a cost, I want to see what the benefit is. Or if you prefer to think in more simplistic terms, maybe your earnings become more stable. And if they become more stable, the price earnings ratio investors are willing to pay becomes higher. But I want to see what I gain as a shareholder from hedging this risk. If there are no significant benefits, I don't care what investment banks have told you about hedging the risk, don't hedge the risk. There's nothing you're gaining in terms of benefits. What's the point of spending money hedging that risk? If there's a benefit, then I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. Can the investors in your company hedge this risk at a lower cost? Now, you see for Disney why that question led me not to hedge risks. Because if your investors are BlackRock and Fidelity and State Street, they're global investors, a lot of the risk you worry about at the company level, they're going to say, don't care about that. And if those investors can hedge the risk cheaper, let them do it. It's much cheaper to let them deal with the risk. I think we overmanage risk at companies. We overhedge risk. Why? Because we listen to sales pitches. In fact, the classic sales pitch that people selling risk hedging product come with is they show what your earnings are without hedging, and they show what your earnings will be with hedging. And you know what you're going to see every single time, right? When you hedge, your earnings are always going to be more stable. And that's the end of the sales pitch. Therefore, you should be hedging. What they're missing is much of the risk you're removing is company-specific risk. And investors don't seem to care as much as companies do about those risks. In fact, the way you see this play out is when companies do their earnings reports, especially the companies with foreign operations, they report the earnings before exchange rate adjustments and after. Because there are some periods where if the dollar gets stronger, you might actually see your earnings drop substantially because of currency effects. If investors care about currency effects, you know what you should see happening, right? If your earnings drop entirely because of currency effects, the stock price should still drop. When you look at the evidence, you don't see that. In fact, when earnings declines come entirely from currency effects, there seems to be no price effect. Investors seem to think of this. In this period you took away, another period you're going to give back, it all evens out. So when you think about hedging, don't jump too fast into the decision process. I'm going to hedge because my earnings will be more stable. You got to go through and ask, does it really make sense for me? Yes. Fine, then use your money. So if you're that comfortable with more stable earnings, maybe you should liquidate portfolio, sell your house, get a second mortgage. You know, this goes back to corporate governance. Whose money are you investing? So I know there are lots of things managers want to do that make them more comfortable. Why should I be, as a shareholder, be paying for your comfort? I'll tell you one way you could tell me that this will work is you're saying, look, all of this is stressing me out. And when I'm stressed out, I make bad decisions. So if you want me to make good decisions for the company, let me hedge risk. In which case, I will let you hedge risk, but look for somebody less stressed to replace you with. Because if you get that stressed that quickly, maybe you're not the right person running a multinational company with a lot of exchange rate movements going on. Yes?
I have a question. This is already in the company's annual reports and quarterly reports, but is this information made publicly available?
There's usually in the footnotes, they will tell you about what they do, but not fully. You know what gives them away? If you're an oil company, you know how I know you're hedging? Is when I look at your revenues and I plot it against oil prices. For most oil companies, the two move almost in lockstep. If your revenues are moving in a way different from oil prices, you don't have to tell me. I know you're playing games here with futures and options. So the debt giveaway is usually tracking the history of the company against a major risk. If it's exchange rate risk, look at how the earnings and revenues move as exchange rates move. So the numbers usually give you away, but some companies do report the numbers. You know, if you look at the footnotes, we'll give you a breakdown of what they hedge and what the hedging products are. Let's talk about acquisitions. In my valuation class, I do a session and a half on acquisitions. And that's all I need, because in a sense, you're going to see what I do in that class in kind of a compressed form. To me, an acquisition is just a gigantic project where what you pay for the company is your initial investment. What you get as cash flows from the company become what you get from the project. And what's the rule with the traditional project? If the net present value is greater than zero, you accept the project. It's true there are a couple of twists to an acquisition. The biggest twist is this word synergy. What does that mean? It's cash flows that will be created only because you're combining the company. So if you look at just the target company, they're not there. But the minute you make it part of this consolidated company or combined company, synergy shows up. But the rules don't change. It's still a project. I can do an NPV of an acquisition. And if it's a good acquisition with the synergy built in, the NPV should be greater than zero. The IRR should exceed your discount rate. I wish companies treated acquisitions as gigantic projects. As I said, one of my biggest concerns with companies is they will spend 50 hours assessing a $20 million project, make you jump through hoop, do whatever questions. But if I make it a $2 billion project or a $20 billion project, all bets are off. I don't do any of the due diligence I do on a $20 million project. So let's talk about how to assess an acquisition. And you're going to see me follow exactly the same rules I did with projects. How do we come up with the discount rate for a project? We looked at how risky the project was or what business it was in and came up with a discount rate for the project, right? Same rule applies in acquisitions. When I look at valuing a target company, you know what discount rate I should be using? It should always be the cost of equity and the cost of capital of the target company. The acquiring company shouldn't even come into play when I do that assessment. That's a rule that's broken about half of all acquisitions right off the bat. The acquiring company's cost of capital is often used to value the target company using some weird logic like we came up with the money, therefore it's our cost. That's no reason. You can come up with the money, you can be a safe company, but you can't transport that cost of capital into the acquisition you're valuing. So the example I'm going to use is this hypothetical example. But Tata Motors is buying Harman Audio, which is primarily a US company, but they're doing it because they want to bring that audio system into their Indian cars in particular. The Jaguar Land Rover is already equipped with top-notch sound systems. They want this for their Indian mass market. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start by valuing Harman Audio as a standalone company. I'm not even going to bring in the synergies, and that's going to look unfair, but later on we will bring the synergies in. So let's go through the process of valuing Harman Audio as a standalone company. The acquirer is an Indian company. The acquirer is an automobile company. You're looking at a high-end automobile. So first thing I'm going to do is estimate the cost of capital that I'm going to use in valuing Harman Audio. Remember, currency is a choice. If you're an Indian company trying to acquire a US company, the currency that's easier to work with is US dollars. All of the financials are in dollars. You could do everything in rupees if you wanted, but why bother? So I'm going to do everything in US dollars. The beta that I used was the beta for electronics companies, not the beta for automobile companies, because Harman Audio is an electronics company. The unlevered beta I used was the beta for electronics companies. For the equity risk premium, I used Harman Audio's geographical exposure, not Tata Motors. Everything is being looked at through the eyes of the target company. And for the debt ratio and cost of capital, I did exactly the same thing. So this is a cost of capital you'd have computed for Harman Audio if it were the company you were assessing in your project. See, where does the acquisition even show up here? Nowhere. The cost of capital that you see there is the cost of capital that I've got for Harman Audio if I were looking at it as a standalone company. Any pushback? I'll give you one piece of ammunition. What if Tata Motors can borrow money at a much lower rate than Harman Audio. Can I replace the cost of debt of Harman Audio with Tata Motors cost? After all, they can borrow at a lower rate. Even if they kept the debt ratio the same, shouldn't that make the cost of capital go down? Again, lots of people do this. They take the acquiring company's cost of debt. It's a AAA rated company that obviously is going to make your cost of capital lower. But think of what this does. If I use a lower cost of capital, what will I do to Harman Audio's value? I'll push it up. If I now pay that higher price to Harman Audio shareholders, the question I'm going to ask you is, what are you paying them for? I mean, there's a rule in acquisitions. Render unto the target company shareholders that which is theirs, not a penny more. This is something you earned, right? The AAA rating. For the last century, be careful about how much you borrow and the business you enter. Attaching your rating and your cost of debt to a target company is giving a premium for something that there's absolutely no role in creating. So my discount rate in dollar terms is going to be 9.67%. Now I'm going to make this valuation as simple as possible because otherwise we'll be doing company valuation for the rest of this class. I'm going to make Harman Audio a mature company. In the most recent year, let's say it had operating income of 201.25 million. And if you look at there, even if you adjust for leases, the number you come up with, so that's how much money they make, 313.2 million with leases adjusted. Remember in 2013, the accountants were not doing this for you. So again, I'm doing the same thing I'd have done for any project, treating leases as debt. They paid 18.21% of their income as taxes. For the reinvestment, I looked at the entire company's depreciation and CapEx. Why? Because remember you add back depreciation to get to cash flows? That doesn't change if you look at a company. And remember how you subtract out CapEx? That doesn't change if you're a company as well. And the change in working capital. So if you look at the items I'm focusing on, operating income, taxes, CapEx, depreciation, working capital. Take a look at the Disney theme park. It looks exactly the same, but now I'm looking at an entire company instead of a single project. One final point. With a project, the capital expenditure you're talking about is capital expenditures related to this project. That's why in the iron ore mining project, there was an upfront CapEx and it kind of disappeared. When you're looking at a company, your CapEx is not for a project, it's for a collection of projects, which means it's never going to go to zero, right? Unless you kind of want to shut the company down. So it's more of an ongoing item that you got to factor in depending on how much growth you see in this company. So I think I'm ready to come up with my cash flows. I start with revenues, come up with operating income. I keep the tax rate at 18.21%. They've got really good lawyers. They managed to pay 18.21% taxes. I'm going to assume that stays in my cash flow. So there's my after-tax operating income. And remember the three adjustments we made to get to cash flows? Add back depreciation, subtract CapEx, subtract change in working capital. Exactly the same adjustments for a company that you do for a project. And because I'm assuming a growth rate of 2.75% a year, the cash flows I will be using for next year will be 166.85 million. You're saying, why is it so much higher than what was? My change in working capital last year was this huge number. But when I projected out the change for next year, I looked at the change in revenues and I said, I'm not reinvesting 275 million in CapEx when my revenues are changing this little. So there's a little more smoothing that goes on because you look at an entire company. You can have lumpy years, big years, small years, a little more judgment call, but it's exactly the same process to come up with my cash flows for next year. So here's what I have. I have my cash flow to the firm next year of 166.85 million. I have my cost of capital of 9.67%. I've got my growth rate of 2.75% a year forever. And the equation for the growing perpetuity, I don't wait till year 10 to do it here because I'm already a mature company. I take the 166.85, which is next year's cash flow, and divide by the difference between the cost of capital and the growth rate forever. What I get as a present value is my estimate of the value of the operating assets at Harman Audio. You're saying, what does that even mean? If a company has cash, I've not valued the cash yet because that interest income is not part of my operating income. So I add cash because it's sitting there. And if I have to subtract out debt, 313 million, the value that I get for the equity is 2.7 billion or 2.678 billion. If I were paying fair value for Harman Audio, I should be paying 2.678 billion with my assumptions driving the numbers. The actual market value of equity was 5.4 billion. Remember, this is a hypothetical acquisition, so don't jump on Tata Motors and accuse them of making about it. But if they'd gone out and paid 5.4 billion, they were paying about 2.75 billion more than my estimated value. Of course, I haven't dealt with synergy yet. Later, I think next class, I'll come back and talk about how would you value synergy here. But we've already got our target to meet, right? So once you value synergy, that synergy has to be worth more than 2.75 billion for this acquisition to become a good acquisition. So let's review the rules and acquisitions, exactly like projects, but now you're looking at the entire company. I look at cash flows by first starting with earnings, adding back depreciation, subtract CapEx, subtract change in working capital, same process. But the biggest rule is in an acquisition, remember that the cost of capital used to discount these cash flows should be the cost of capital for the target company, because it's their risk that's driving these cash flows. And you can get an intrinsic valuation or value to the target company. Any questions on the on project analysis? So we looked at, you know, one project, the Disney theme park, we looked at cash flows of the firm, discounted the cost of capital. One project where we use the equity perspective on a finite life project. So compare the finite with the longer life projects and see what we did differently. And the third slice we took was we looked at an acquisition. We looked at an entire company. As long as you keep this the basics of how you do capital budgeting nailed down, you can extend this to valuation. You can look at any set of cash flows because the rules remain exactly the same. So now I want to kind of revisit the three, in each of the three projects, what was my rule? The net present value is greater than zero, except the project, right? They were independent projects, which means this project was affecting nothing else in the company. In the real world, it's tough to do because often you're picking between projects. Do I open a Disney theme park or spend money on streaming? If they're both good, you should be taking both. But let's say you're a company that has to pick between projects. There are some cases where the projects are mutually exclusive, where if you take one, you can't do the other. You can say, do I want to invest in China on small scale or large scale? You can't do both. You got to pick whichever one's better. So I want to talk about picking between projects and deciding what investment decision rules will help you the best or help you the most in making those choices. So let's talk about mutually exclusive projects because that's, I think, the easiest scenario to work. So again, mutually exclusive projects means you have two projects. If you pick one, you can't pick the other. If any of you buy houses or buy homes, this is a question you're going to constantly face, right? Your roof is coming apart. You've got to put in a new roof and you get two contractors coming with two different numbers. One says you can spend $15,000, but your roof will last 3 years. And the other says if you pay $50,000, your roof will last forever. You have to pick. Those are mutually exclusive projects. You can't do both. So I want to start with mutually exclusive projects and talk about the two decision rules that are time-weighted incremental cash flow rules, NPV and IRR. Because up till now, we said the two give you roughly the same answer. We didn't make a big deal. But now that we're picking between projects, we might have to make choices. So we're going to talk about the differences between NPV and IRR. And I'm going to talk about three things. One is I'm going to talk about why, you know, at least in textbooks, there is this dependence. NPV is viewed as the best rule. I'll give you the basis for it. Why I disagree with that conclusion, because there are some companies where I think it makes more sense to look at IRR. And then focus on this hidden assumption in both these rules that we never even think about called the reinvestment assumption. What happens to that cash flow you get in year one and year two? Where does that money go? What does it get reinvested? Remember, they're both time-weighted incremental cash flow returns. We're not computing return on capital to NPV. There we know why there are differences. Here we're computing NPV to IRR to see why we get different decision rules. So I'm going to start with my first example. I have two projects. One is front expense. The other one, I mean, they're both, if you look at the two projects, they both look like pretty conventional projects. One has $1 billion of, they both have $1 billion, and then you have cash flows. But in the project one, in year four, you have a second negative cash flow, back-ended licensing fee. So you got negative, 3 years of positive, negative. The second project is more conventional, negative upfront, positive later. If I computed the NPVs of these two rules, I can get an answer. But if I do the IRRs, I get something that at first sight looks odd. You know how when I did the projects, I came up with an IRR was a single number with the NPV profile. When I do the NPV profile of project B, I get a single number. There's my IRR. It's about 11%. But when I do the IRR for the first project, there's an IRR around 6%, another one around 36%. In other words, if you ask me, what's the IRR of project A? I'm going to give you, it's either 6% to 36%. It's weird because with the 36%, it's a great project. With the 6%, it's a terrible project. Before we dig into what you would do, I have a question of why this is happening. What is it about project A? And I'll show you the two projects. What is it about project A that's creating two internal rates of return? There are two sign changes. Sounds like inside mathematics, but in a typical project, you have negative upfront and then you have positive all the way through. This project, there's a sign change from year zero to one and another one from year three to four. We don't think of it in these terms, but an internal rate of return is actually a root to an equation. Thank God we don't have to actually solve for that root. No, we do this what-if analysis to get there. Every time you have a sign change, there's an additional root to your equation. So if you have two sign changes, there are two IRRs. If you have three sign changes, you can have three IRRs. Why would you ever run into something like that? If you have a 30-year project where every 5 years you got to make a major investment to keep the project going, you could very well have six sign changes, right? Which means at least in theory, you can end up with six internal rates of return. I remember about 10 years ago, somebody worked at a hedge fund, sent in, they had a client who wanted to know what percentage return the hedge fund had delivered to him over the lifetime. And he had like 36 months of data. The only problem was this hedge fund, this client brought in money in some months, took out money in other months. So when you looked at the cash flows for this client, I think they changed signs 16 times. Which means at least in theory, there are 16 different internal rates of return I can compute. So you think, what do I do then? I'm going to cut this very simple. I know there are entire books on what to do when you have multiple IRRs. If I wrote a book on what to do if you have multiple IRRs, it would be one sentence. If you have multiple IRRs, use the NPV. You always, there's only one NPV. No matter how complex you make a project, you will never have multiple. This is an artifact of internal rate of return. There's nothing you can do about it that makes any sense. And all the tricks they teach you, like you can take the negative cash flow and move it all to year zero and make it look like it happens in year zero, are just tricks. Multiple IRRs basically ruin your IRR calculation. Now, luckily I said, you have 16 sign changes, you have 16 IRRs. Many of those IRRs are so far out of the normal rep, 10,500% that you never even see them when you do a profile. So the simplest way to check if you have a problem is do the NPV profile. If nothing happens within your range, just let it go. Even if there are multiple sign changes, take the IRR you get within that range. So that's the first reason why NPVs and IRRs can vary. And when they vary, as I said, go with the NPV. The NPV is always going to give you one answer. The cash flows, and it's a much more sensible answer. I don't know with your project whether you have multiple sign changes over time, but if you do, it might not even show up in your NPV profile, but it could affect you when you use the IRR function. The original version of Excel, I think 30 years ago, if you wanted to do an IRR of a set of cash flows, you'd have to use the IRR function, you'd have to provide the cash flows, and you have to give them a guess. Or what you thought the IRR was. You know why they made you guess? Because then if there were multiple IRRs, they picked the one close. They never told you this, but they just picked the one closer to your guess and said, you guessed 10%, the IRR that's closest to it is 12%. That's what I'm going to give you. Any questions about multiple internal rates of return and why they happen? Take a second guess. Here you have two projects. They both have the same life. Same life is going to be critical, especially when you compare NPVs. First project is a $1 million project, and those are my cash flows for the next 4 years. 350,000, 450,000, 600, 750. The second project is a much bigger project. It's 10 times bigger, $10 million in your cash flows for the next 4 years. I've computed the NPVs for the two projects and the IRRs for the two projects. Remember, they're mutually exclusive. If you pick projects based on NPV, the second project is clearly much better. If you pick projects based on IRR, the first project is much better. And this is going to happen most of the time when you compare projects of different sizes. Why is that? Why will NPV bias you towards bigger projects and IRR bias you towards smaller projects? Basically, NPV is a dollar value, right? If you take a $5 billion project, you're much more likely, even if that project is mildly good, to end up with a big positive NPV. IRR is a percentage number. It'll bias you towards smaller projects. As I said, in almost every textbook you open up, you'll be told that NPV is better than IRR. It's kind of a religion in finance textbooks. But when people say that they're actually making an implicit assumption about companies, and I want you to be explicit about what that implicit assumption is, make it explicit. So I want you to think about when, you know, think about as a decision maker, right? You've got these two projects. Project A is smaller, has a higher IRR. Project B is bigger and has a bigger NPV. Let's play this through. Let's say you pick project A because it has a higher IRR. What are you implicitly assuming is going to happen over the rest of the year? Remember, your entire, let's say your entire capital budget is 10 million, right? So you take the first project, costs you only $1 million. What are you assuming you're going to be able to do with the remaining 9 million? That you can find more good projects, not just more projects with positive net present value. So if you take project A, your biggest nightmare is you take project A and you wait for the rest of the year and no good projects come about, in which case, the remaining 9 million ends up with a net present value of zero because you keep it in cash. If you take project B, you've used up your 10 million, right? What's your nightmare scenario? Great project comes along 2 weeks from now, and you're unable to raise the money to take that great project. You're saying, why do textbooks not worry about that? Why do textbooks still tell you to use NPV? What are we implicitly assuming about companies that allows us to say NPV is the better decision? That great project comes along 2 weeks from now. What do I assume you can do? You go out and raise capital. If you live in a world with no capital constraints, do you see why NPV is always a better decision rule? Take the better project in terms of NPV, and if a better project comes along 2 weeks from now, go out and raise fresh money. So I'm going to ask you a question about what kinds of companies should use NPV and what kinds of companies should use IRR. And the answer is pretty obvious, right? If you're a company which has no capital rationing constraints, if you're Tesla, you shouldn't be complaining about not having cash. You can go out and raise as much as you want. People are willing to pay huge prices. You're a liquid company, a big market cap company. Just go with NPV. If on contrast, you're a company that has constraints, you're a small company, you're a private company, you're a company in an emerging market where you might not have access to capital, you should probably look at IRR first because you worry about the fact that you will run out of capital. So if you have a worry about running out of capital, if you have a capital rationing constraint, then I can see why you might prefer to use IRR over NPV because you want to get the most bang for your buck. Do you think most companies face a capital rationing constraint or don't? So if I looked across, let's say, you know, even in the US, I'd take the S&P 500. In theory, none of them should really face a capital rationing constraint. Right? You're one of the S&P 500, you have a large market cap, your stock is traded. Do you think they face most companies? I mean, many of you worked at large companies, right? Do you think they acted like they were in a capital rationing constraint? So where does that constraint come from? Now, there's actually studies that look at constraints. And you know, most companies believe that they're capital constrained, even big companies. You know where that constraint comes from? It doesn't come from outside. It's not because you can't raise capital. It's because they choose not to raise capital. Remember, when you want to go out and raise capital, if you're a company that doesn't want to get hopelessly over-levered, what do you have to be willing to do? If you have a lot of great projects, you got to be willing to issue new shares, right? You're saying, what's the big deal? At least in the US, companies hate to issue new shares once they go public. They might borrow money, but even there, they have constraints. So what I'm trying to say is a lot of capital rationing constraints are internally imposed. So if you tell me I'm never going to issue shares from this day on, you could be the largest, most liquid company in the world, but I still have to worry about, could you potentially face constraints? Of course, if you're a company like Google with $120 billion in cash, I'm not worried. But you can see how this constraint can come about. So any questions about capital rationing? Capital rationing is both internal and external. Don't assume that every large company which is liquid doesn't face a constraint, because you can still have internally imposed constraints based on what managers put on themselves. One way in which you can still stay with NPV, even with the capital rationing constraint, is there's this alternative measure called the PI, the profitability index. You're saying, what is that? I take the NPV and divide it by my initial investment. So remember the example that I had, the first project in the NPV of 467,937. The initial investment was a million. You divide the NPV by the initial investment, you get a PI of 46.79%. The way to think about this is it scales the NPV to however big your project is. So if you don't like IRR, you've taken your finance textbooks to heart and says, IRR is terrible, I don't want to use it. You want to stay with NPV and you have a capital rationing constraint. This is kind of a shortcut you could use to deal with the fact that you have a capital rationing constraint. So NPV, you can have only one. IRR, you can have multiple IRRs. NPV is going to bias you towards big projects. IRR is going to bias you towards small projects. Neither way, I'm not using the bias in a bad way. I'm just saying that's you have to expect that kind of tilt in your decisions. There's one final example I want to talk about. And this is where the subtle assumptions you make with NPV and IRR come to the surface. I have two projects here. Both are $10 million projects. So they're same scale. So you can't compare about the projects being different scales. I have cash flows for the next 4 years. The patterns are a little different. The first project is an NPV of 1.19 million. The second project, project B, has a higher NPV. But the first project has the higher IRR. It's one of those mysteries. They're both time weighted. They're both incremental cash flow. They're both the same scale. So what are these two approaches doing differently that leads you to different choices? Okay, so that's fine. So tell me what happens. I agree with you. It's the inversion of the cash flows, but they're both time weighted. Earlier cash flows are better than, so there must be something in the weighting process that's different, right? So what is it that's happening with these two approaches that's leading to divergence? Anybody want to try? Take the first project. At the end of year one, I get 5 million, right? What happens to that 5 million? It gets reinvested. At what rate? If you're using the NPV approach, it gets reinvested at your cost of capital, your hurdle rate. If you're using IRR, it gets reinvested at the IRR. Which one's a more dangerous assumption to make? That you can reinvest at your cost of capital or reinvest at the IRR? The IRR, because the cost of capital is what you can make on other, you can invest in a mutual fund and make your cost of equity. But if your IRR is 50%, I'm assuming not just that this project will have an IRR of 50%, but there are other projects in my choice that also make 50%. A lot of private equity investors often, when they present their whatever company they're investing in to clients, will show the IRR. They don't show NPV. And even if you take their cash flows as a given and they say my IRR is 48%, you know the question you need to ask them is, right? Hey, this project has a 48% IRR, but where are all these other magical projects going to show up that allow me to invest what I get in year one and year two and year three? The true IRR for this project will be much lower if you don't have those projects out there. It's called the reinvestment rate assumption. It's implicit, so people are not even aware of it, but it can get you into a lot of trouble, especially when you get to higher IRRs for projects with very long lives. because then you're assuming that you can keep reinvesting this money at a higher rate. So when you look at these projects, they look like they have the same life, same scale, but the two approaches can lead you to different answers. And by itself, this is one place where you can argue the NPV approach makes better, more reasonable assumptions than the IRR approach. Let me ask you a question. Let's say you fall in love with IRR. A lot of private equity investors, as I said, love IRR. Is there a way I can modify my IRR to fix this reinvestment rate assumption? The end of year one, I get 5 million, right? What's the IRR approach assuming that I can reinvest that at my IRR? What would be a more reasonable assumption? I can assume that it gets reinvested not at the IRR, but at the cost of capital or the cost of equity, whatever my hurdle rate is. Left to itself, the IRR rule has this flaw. It's not a fatal flaw, but it's a dangerous flaw, a flaw that can potentially get you into trouble. And if you can fix it, you can still stay with IRR, but adjust for that assumption. And that's basically what I did here. I took a project with an initial investment of 1,000. The traditional IRR was 24.89%. There, I'm assuming that my 300 million that I get in year one gets reinvested at 24.89%. In year two, whatever cash flow I get. What if instead of doing that, I took my cash flows, and let's say my cost of capital is 15%. I took my cash flow in year one, reinvested at 15% for the remaining 3 years of the project. So each cash flow, what I do is I collect the cash flow, invest it explicitly at the cost of capital. I add up what I'll have in the bank at the end of the period, 2160. Now I have an initial investment of 1,000. I have 2160 in the bank at the end of 4 years. The modified internal rate of return that I get from those cash flows is going to be lower because it reflects the fact that I'm making 15% of my intermediate cash flows. If you get a chance, take those project A and project B I showed you, compute the modified IRR for those projects at the cost of capital. It'll be lower than my IRR. Your rankings will then be the same with NPV and IRR. The differences will go away. So what I'm saying is, hey, if you're using NPV or IRR, you're already 95% of the way towards where I'd like you to be. It's a time-weighted incremental cash flow return. I'm not going to fight and die on this hill, say you should be using NPV. If you really, really want to use IRR, I'm absolutely okay with it. And if you're worried about the reinvestment rate assumption, I can fix it. But don't create fights about things that really don't matter that much. I've seen people walk out of analysis saying, you're not going to use NPV, you're not following the rules. I'm okay with either NPV or IRR. I'm glad you're not using accounting return on capital, to be quite honest, or payback. So, go ahead.
If you take the NPV,
yeah.
And if you compound that over the 5 year period, that should be the same.
With the NPV, yeah, that's why the rankings were there, but it'll still be a dollar value, right? There's no compounding involved. That's basically what
the NPV between the initial investment versus the compounded value.
That's what the modified IRR is. So, basically, that's exactly what I'm doing, is I'm making explicit what the NPV is assuming in my cash flows, and that's what the modified IRR is calculated. So let's summarize. If you have projects with equal lives and the cash flows change sign more than once, you can have more than one IRR, but you can have only one NPV. If your projects are of different size, NPV is going to tilt you towards a bigger project, IRR is going to tilt you towards a smaller project. And that could be an issue depending on whether you have a capital rationing constraint or not. And finally, the NPV makes the reasonable assumption that you can earn whatever cash flows you generate, get reinvested at the cost of capital or cost of equity. The IRR makes the assumption that intermediate cash flows earn a return well above your hurdle rate. Now let's talk about projects with different lives. You see, what do different lives matter? With NPV, it does, and you can see why. Here I have two projects, a 5 year project and a 10 year project. They're mutually exclusive. So if I pick one, I can't take the other. So if you look at the NPV of project one, it's 442 million. The NPV of project two is 478. So if I compare NPVs, the second project looks better than the first project, right? But here's the catch. The first project lasts only 5 years. What happens after year five? If I just compare NPVs, I'm assuming after year five, there's nothing, no positive NPV at all. Comparing NPVs across projects with different lives is a little unfair to shorter life projects because the longer life project is always going to look better. IRR is not affected. This again might be a reason why you prefer to use IRRs. IRRs are percentage returns, but NPVs are contaminated by the fact that shorter life projects have less, fewer cash flows. So I want to ask you a question. If I wanted to compare these two projects and make it a more even playing field, it's the simplest way I could do it. In other words, double the first project, right? If I make the assumption, it's a big F, that I can do project A twice. In other words, I come back and invest another $1,000 at the end of year five and get the same cash flows. You'd have two 10-year projects. It's called replication. I have two projects and I want to compare NPVs. I can replicate them till they have the same life. Sounds easy, right? If I have a 5 and a 10, it's simple. But what if I gave you a 7-year and a 9-year project? You know what you'd have to do to replicate? You'd have to do the 7-year project 9 times and the 9-year project 7 times. So basically, I just have to pick two big prime numbers and throw them at you. And you're going to be kind of stuck trying to find a common number that you can work with. So I'm going to give you a shortcut that'll work. So you can do the replication, compare the NPVs, or you can convert the NPV into an annuity. It's a neat little trick. Because the problem with NPVs, it's a number that reflects what you earn over the life of a project. If I could take that NPV and said, if I were making this as an annual cash flow, what would it work out to? Now, I don't know whether the old days you used to get these ads for magazines, where you want to renew your magazine and say you can renew your magazine for 1 year for $24, for 2 years for $44. In other words, it's a big, and for 3 years at $60. Basically, what they want you to compare is just taking the total amount and dividing by the number of years. That's what we do to compare. The only problem when you do that, though, is you pay the money up front. So you're comparing basically apples and oranges. The longer life project will always look better. So you're going to renew for 3 years. And that's what they want you to do. Now, I'm not suggesting you do this on your magazine subscriptions. It's overkill. But what you're not factoring is the time value of money there, right? If I could somehow take that $60 you pay over 3 years and give you an annuity that factors in your time value of money and say, $60 over 3 years is not $20 a year. It's like $22.35 if you factor in interest rates. If you have a financial calculator, you know what I've done, right? I've entered the 60 as your present value. N is 3 years. And if you're making 10% on your money, I put R is 10%, and then I look for the payment. I've converted a lump sum today into an annuity. Now, enough of the abstraction, but here's what I did. The replication, here's what I get. If I replicate project one, twice, I have a 10-year project for both, the NPV of project one now becomes higher. There is a danger here though, right? At the end of year five, I'm assuming that I can find another project just like project A. Could I change that assumption? Absolutely. I could say the second time I do it, instead of making 400 a year, I'm gonna make 300 a year. So it's flexible enough that if you want to change the assumptions for the second leg, you can do it, but then NPVs will still be comparable. But here's the annuity approach. I have the NPV, right? For the first project, 442 million. It's a 5-year project. My discount rate is 12%. I convert the NPV into an annuity. Again, all I'm doing is entering a PV of 442 million in my calculator. N is 5 years, R is 12%, looking for the payment. You think, what is that 122.62 million? Tell me. You'd be indifferent between a project with an NPV where I give you 442 million today or 122.62 million every year for the next 5 years. I've converted my NPV into an annuity. I do the same thing with the second project, 10-year project, but now I convert it into an annuity over 10 years, I get 84.6 million. So the question I'm asking you is, would you rather receive an annuity of 84.6 or 122.62? And the answer is, I'll take 122.62 as my annual cash flow. And because they're both annuities, they can be compared to each other. Again, if you ever own a home, this is a great exercise because if you don't convert for time value, your longer life option is always going to look cheaper, right? Because you're just saying, if I spend $15,000 on flooring for my kitchen, that's going to last 20 years, and I have to pay $5,000 for a 10-year, the $15,000 over 20 years is always going to work out less money. I'm sorry, $15,000 for 20 years and $10,000 for 10. you're going to pick the 15,000 because it looks cheaper, but you're paying the money today. There's a time value involved. So think of this as a more slightly more sophisticated way of bringing in what your annual cost is that factors in the time value of money. So we've looked at NPV, we've looked at IRR, we looked at accounting return on capital, return equity. We even looked at payback, right, as a risk adjustment mechanism. And along the way, we computed this PI, the profitability index. So let's say you become CFO of a company. You are going to now lay down the way in which people in the company are going to look at projects. And I'm going to let you choose based on all the pluses and minuses. Now, what are you first going to look at? What company am I CFO of, right? If you're CFO of 3M or Coca-Cola, you might think very differently to the process. But I want you to think about this choice. What do you think would be your, how many of you would go with an accounting returnster? Okay, so I'm glad that we got that out of the way. But the reality is you might be working in an environment where people have used returns on capital. You'll have an education job in front of you to try to convince people why you need to share. So really the choice you're facing is NPV versus IRR, right? So let's see what these numbers have looked like over time. The last survey I was able to find was in 1998. I'd love to see a 2023 survey. But this was a survey that looked at what companies used as their primary decision rule. Many used three or four, but they had one dominant decision rule. In 1976, IRR was 54% of all companies. Across all three periods, IRR was the dominant decision rule in every single time period. So much as we like to talk about NPVs in the class, many people still prefer percentage returns. So get comfortable with IRR, modified IRR, because you're going to run into that law. In 1976, the second most widely used approach was accounting return. These were big companies. So the numbers are probably even more skewed when you look at small companies. One in four companies was using a return on capital or return on equity. NPV was less than 10%. Payback was about 9%. And that was their primary decision rule. They decide on projects. Will I get paid back in 3 years or 5 years? And 3% use profitability index. Go forward to 86. The big jump is in NPV. It's gone from less than 10% to 21%. All the lecturing that we've done in finance classrooms maybe made a difference. So people are getting more rational. But there's a twist to what happened in 86. It's true there was a big jump in NPV, but you notice the other metric where there was a big jump in? Payback went from less than 10% to almost 20%. It makes no sense, right? Payback has no time value involved. Why do you think companies still hold on to payback? What kinds of companies do you think look at payback first before they look at everything else? Well, if you're a young company, look at payback. You're not going to be taking any, what project is going to pay off, right? Because I'll give you a clue. In the 1980s, you saw the rise of leveraged acquisitions and leveraged buyouts. If you're leveraged, what's your first item on your to-do list? You've got to pay the debt back, which means you don't have the luxury of saying 30-year projects, big NPV. You're looking at what cash flows can I get next year, 2 years out, 3 years out. Part of this reflects the pressure you feel when you're levered to pay the cash. I'll wager if you take the 21%, you get a very large subset of highly levered companies saying, I need to make my money back before we can talk about any kind of returns. What I'm trying to say is don't get wedded to any particular decision rule. Be willing to deal with different kinds of decision rules because none of them is bad. None of them is irrational. There's always a reason. And your job then is to take your preferred decision rule and say, can I modify that to reflect what you're most worried about? Right? Because it is not, I think it is logical. It is rational to worry about, will I be able to pay off the debt? But using payback might still give you a bad project because you're so focused on taking short-term projects to generate the cash flows that you might be leaving a lot of long-term value on the table. I'm going to stop with that because next session, we're going to start with the case. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about side costs and side benefits, how they play out, including synergy in an acquisition. but opportunity costs, side costs, all those costs that are created for other players in the game. I will see you on Wednesday, and I hope to see your cases before we start class on Wednesday.